Today is Thursday, August 24th. We're going to be working on adrenal glands, pancreas, and blood typing today. Okay, bottom of page 13 has several endocrine disorders related to the adrenal glands. Let me start you there. And we were talking in class on Tuesday about the problem with Addison's disease. This particular disorder is a hyposecretion issue. And what two hormones are primarily affected? Good, aldosterone and cortisol. Good, those are the two primary ones affected by this condition. So there's a whole lot of problems that can arise from having had too little aldosterone or cortisol. What kinds of issues might you relate to having little levels of aldosterone? Yeah, low blood pressure, right. So we think of low blood pressure issues as being related to having too little aldosterone. What else might crop up? Other issues that might crop up are things like PICA, which is a craving for mineral-rich things, whether they're food or not. And so maybe we're low in sodium, for instance, and that would lead to PICA. What are some conditions or symptoms that we might see cropping up with low cortisone levels? What's that?
Weight loss.
Good. Yeah, weight loss. We may see things like muscle fatigue and weakness. So the body is not able to basically function at the level it needs with the proper levels of cortisol. So Addison's disease may be just a cortisone issue. It may be just an aldosterone issue. And it may, in fact, be both of those being insufficient in production. Okay, so that's kind of where we were at in here on Tuesday. I did want to mention to you that one famous person we do believe had Addison's disease. JFK back in the early 1960s was president, and his inner circle of friends believed that he might have Addison's disease, and they were scared that he would die in office from this disease. And you know, back in that time period, color television was brand new. A lot of people still had black and white televisions, and so those who saw him on TV, on color TV, probably thought, wow, he's tanned, he probably is athletic and he's outside. And you know, he did play golf and he did do some stuff outside, but the tanning, they believe, was actually not due to being outside. They think that some of the darkening effects of his skin actually was due to Addison's disease. So you know, if you know the story of him, he was assassinated in office, so we never would have known the outcome of what happened if he indeed did have Addison's disease. So this is Addison's disease also. You know, I wouldn't necessarily think of body-wide tanning as the effect of Addison's, but rather splotches of tanning or darkening here and there. This could be melanoma. Melanoma has been known to crop up in weird places. Most people don't get sun exposure to their gums though, right? So nonetheless, if you have darkening in places that normally don't get sun exposure, then we look at something like melanoma, we look at something like Addison's disease to figure out what the underlying cause is. All right. Let's kind of go in another direction. Let's head in the opposite direction, in fact. Let's talk about Cushing's disease. And the word Cushing kind of gives you a hint. This disease makes the body cushiony and fat. Okay? So Cushing's disease, you'll notice, is hypersecretion of what hormone?
Cortisol.
Good. Before you get lost in all the symptoms up here for Cushing's, let's first talk about the role of cortisol in the body. What does cortisol do for your blood sugar levels? Raises them, good. Maintains long-term blood sugar, right? And so what does cortisol break down to make sure you increase blood sugar over the long term? Protein, good. Proteins and fats get broken down by cortisol. Okay, so that's one thing we're going to think about here. Another thing we're looking at is the cortisol is an anti-inflammatory kind of chemical. So it basically suppresses your immune function and makes your immune system not quite as active. Okay, so when you think about those two things and look at the list here, some of these don't come quite as a big surprise. When you think about obesity, weight gain around the face is what we call moon face. Stretch marks come from quick growth due to weight gain. So we look at these kinds of symptoms as being directly tied to that whole issue of glucose being maintained by cortisol. You okay? Okay, other issues here kind of look odd. Things like hirsutism, that comes from male patterns of body hair growth. So you might not normally think of this as being an issue with cortisol, but other hormones kind of get tied into this hypersecretion effort. What are the hormones made by the adrenal gland might cause excess hair growth? Does aldosterone do it? No, aldosterone doesn't make your hair grow. What other hormones are made by that deepest layer of your adrenal gland?
Sex hormones,
right. So if you're hyper-secreting testosterone from your adrenal gland, there's that symptom of hirsutism or excess hair growth. Many years ago, I was teaching a class out here, and a student came up to me after class and said that she had Cushing's disease, and she had been diagnosed and treated for it. And what had happened was she had been experiencing weight gain, and she was very uncomfortable with the weight gain because she said she didn't drink alcohol, and she was very careful to watch her diet, so it was very alarming to her to experience a sudden weight gain. So she put herself on a restrictive diet of tuna fish and crackers for 3 months, and she thought that maybe that would help trim off any of this excess weight loss. Well, she didn't lose weight over those 3 months. She continued to gain weight over those 3 months. So unfortunately, she said, all right, trip to the doctor is necessary. This is beyond my control. And when she was diagnosed with Cushing's and realized that this was the list of symptoms, it was like a light bulb had clicked and gone off for her. She had the irritability and depression and anxiety symptom. She did have the male patterns of hair growth. She said she had a little pot belly growing, even though she didn't drink and overeat. She was a very small, thin-framed person. So, you know, these symptoms fell right in line with what she was experiencing. So what do you think they did for her? How do you think they solved the problem of Addison's disease? Cushing's, yeah, thank you. How do you think they solved this problem? Yeah, that's kind of noisy. Where are some places that we could look to potentially solve the problem?
They had to lower, yeah.
Look at the adrenal glands, and if the adrenal glands were directly causing the problem, then they back up a step and look where? Pituitary gland, yeah. And in fact, her problem was a pituitary tumor, not an adrenal gland tumor. So they surgically removed her pituitary gland to eliminate further problems. The issue of taking out the pituitary is not an easy job. They have to go up through your nose and back into your brain and very carefully snip out the anterior portion of the adrenal and pituitary and remove it. So the issue of taking out your pituitary is not simple. Because it is made up of endocrine gland tissue, it can regrow. So they told her when they snipped out the anterior pituitary, hey, this may work and it may not work because in a number of years we may have to revisit this issue. So I know that was probably a really scary thought for her. So Cushing's can be caused by a pituitary tumor. It can also be caused by an adrenal gland tumor. Either way, the symptoms pretty much fall out to be the same, hypersecretion of cortisol.
After it was removed, what kind of medication?
Boy, she was on a handful. She took thyroid medications because now the TSH was no longer being produced. She had to take sex hormones to regulate her like menstrual ovarian cycle. She was in her early 30s when this tumor had arisen. I also had a student about a year ago have the surgery done. She had problems with thirst, so it apparently affected her ADH storage in her posterior pituitary. So it seems to be that after a period of time, the medication seems to level itself out, but it's a very rocky road for things like ADH, thyroid, sex hormones, all at the very beginning. Yeah, quite a handful of pills. I did want to mention that Cushing's can be induced by taking medications like prescription steroid medications. You know, you do have over-the-counter hydrocortisone at home, which is a like a lotion or a cream that you can rub onto your body. But more impactful than that would be by mouth steroid medications. So someone who takes a long-term course of steroids, perhaps for organ transplant, is going to be at higher risk for Cushing's than other people who take maybe just a little bit of cream of hydrocortisone and rub it on their skin once in a while. This is Cushing's. This is classic looking moon face on the left. The little boy has some type of tumor. It obviously was handled, and after the fact that the surgery was taken care of, you can see the weight loss around his face. A little girl here with Cushing's. Stretch marks come from the quick weight gain. And basically what the body does is it shuffles off this sugar manufacturing process. It takes fats and proteins and breaks them down into usable sugar. If you don't use the sugar, what do we then do with that sugar?
Store it back as fat.
Store it back as fat, right. So you can take a lean, muscular body, break down that muscle tissue into sugar, and then restore that sugar back as fat. And so that's how weight gain can come, even if you reduce the calorie intake. More stretch marks. And another side issue with Cushing's is called a buffalo hump. When babies are born, they actually have a bit of brown fat, which is between your shoulder blades. And that brown fat is there to help them survive until mom's breast milk comes in. So, you know, nowadays we have bottled milk and stuff, so there's usually not an issue with having a baby go a week without being fed. But, you know, that's the whole point of this brown fat, is to make sure that babies have a little bit of fat storage as they're coming into the world. Well, with Cushing's disease, it causes fat storage everywhere, including on the back, between the shoulder blades. Interesting that they were able to catch a before picture of this woman and an after picture. That little bit of fat stored there is called a buffalo hump of fat, and that happens to be a side effect of Cushing's syndrome. So I don't know how many people check out their backs in the mirror, but, you know, it's an interesting thing to notice, besides all the other features. And another man with Cushing's had surgery. Probably the pituitary or the adrenal. That's the two most likely locations that we're looking at. Okay, and so the last issue down there is masculinization of women, and I'll draw your attention to the very bottom of page 13. So the adrenal glands make two types of sex hormones. They make small amounts of androgens, which are male sex hormones, and very small amounts of estrogen. So for a female to experience an increase or an uptick in those testosterone-related hormones, she may experience what's called masculinization of a female. So in this case, we do have the bearded lady effect. You know, back in the day, the bearded lady toured with the circus. There's pictures of pretty full beards here from back in that time period. And, you know, poor bearded lady, she had probably an adrenal gland disorder. But they didn't understand that back then, and, you know, of course, this was a way to make money if you were the bearded lady. Nowadays, beards may not be quite so predominant. It can be something as subtle as peach fuzz around the face. But nonetheless, this comes from the testosterone secreted by the adrenal glands. So we have to look at those adrenal glands as being the problem. Even little kids can experience adrenal gland problems. This is a 3-year-old with an adrenal gland tumor. It could have been a pituitary tumor as well, but you'll notice the pubic hair that's growing here comes from what's called precocious puberty. It's an early onset of puberty. Nobody wants a 3-year-old having a period or going through puberty. You know, 3-year-olds are tantrum enough, right? So this nowadays is treated. They put this child into what's called like a suspended animation for their puberty. And this child will hang in suspended animation until they're old enough, you know, maybe say age 11 or 13, and then they'll say, okay, let the hormones go. And then so they release the suspended animation, and that child can then go through puberty. Besides the obvious issues of having a 3-year-old go through puberty, what does that do to the child's growth?
Would it make them grow faster?
Yeah, they'll skip that. They'll have that growth spurt. They'll skip those childhood years of growing taller. And what does testosterone or estrogen do to epiphyseal plates? Closes them. Yeah. So it does cause a growth spurt, but yeah, it'll close those plates, and that will be it for upward growth in that child. So not just the sex hormone issue. It's important for all of that child's upward growth to stop this in its tracks. Okay. Just a little bit on page 14 about the adrenal medulla. I know you guys have talked about autonomic nervous system in Bio210, so I just want to take a moment to revisit the autonomic nervous system. The autonomic nervous system is an automatic system, and it controls involuntary events. Does your autonomic nervous system control your skeletal muscles? No. So what kinds of things are controlled by your autonomic nervous system?
Heart rate.
Heart rate, that's a good one.
Digestion.
Okay, so we're looking at thoracic and abdominopelvic visceral organ cavities there. Those ventral body cavities have major organs that are controlled by your autonomic nervous system. So when we're thinking about the adrenal medulla, it produces two chemicals, adrenaline and noradrenaline, alternately known as epinephrine and norepinephrine, and these operate for a specific branch of your autonomic nervous system. Which branches, or which branch rather, do they work for? Sympathetic, or? Yeah, sympathetic, right. So parasympathetic, by contrast, utilizes acetylcholine. This branch, the sympathetic branch, utilizes epinephrine and its buddy norepinephrine. By the way, those two, epinephrine and norepinephrine, are considered synergist. So what do they do? They work together, exactly. So they are going to cause pretty much the same effects. There may be receptors for one more so than the other in certain locations, but for the most part, they are synergistic, doing the same effects. Some of the things that epinephrine and norepinephrine encourage are increased blood glucose levels during a fight or flight response. So, you know, if you're driving through traffic, you're getting sleepy, and you start to doze off, then of course, if you're sleepy and then drift into oncoming traffic, you're then startled awake and experience a fight or flight response, including increased blood glucose to handle the fight or the flight. You're going to experience an increase in heart rate and blood pressure. Will dilate your breathing passageways. What is the benefit of doing that?
More oxygen in
the blood. Yeah, get more oxygen in, good. And then at the same time, we're increasing thoracic cavity activity. We are decreasing abdominopelvic cavity activity. So digestive and urinary functions kind of slow down and take a back seat, because right now during fight or flight response, it's survival mode. You either got to put up a fight, go with the flight, or, you know, manage to survive through whatever this crisis is. So things like physical activity, emergencies, exercise will put you in this fight or flight mode, the sympathetic nervous system mode. Let's go back to what we talked about in here on day one. If epinephrine is released from one neuron to another neuron, we call it what? Is it a hormone or a neurotransmitter? From one neuron to the next neuron? It's a neurotransmitter, right. If, however, we put that chemical in the bloodstream, it's now a hormone. Yeah. So epinephrine and norepinephrine work both ways. They work over a sympathetic nervous system pathway from one neuron to the next, and they can also work as hormones getting into your bloodstream. So even if they're in your bloodstream, they take at least 30 minutes to remove. Your liver has to break down and remove the hormone products from the bloodstream. So even 30 minutes later, you still may be keyed up after having had a fight or flight response. Okay, last one here is pancreas. That is going to be on page 15. This is not the only time we'll talk about the pancreas. We'll do it again for the digestive system. The pancreas is a endocrine gland, and it's also a digestive organ. It's wedged behind your stomach, partially in the peritoneum, and it has a dual purpose. It actually has a purpose of secreting enzymes for your digestive system, and it also makes two hormones. What are those hormones made by the islet cells? Good. Insulin and glucagon. Good. So they used to be called the islets of Langerhans. I don't know, that sounds like an island to me. Islets are just specific cells in your pancreas. Nowadays, they're trying to move away from naming things for people. So nowadays, we just call them the pancreatic islets. But those are the specific cells that make insulin and glucagon. To be more specific than that, insulin is made by a specific islet cell called a beta cell. And glucagon is made by a specific islet cell called an alpha cell. Okay, so let me tell you my helpful hint here. Glucagon has an A, alpha starts with an A. In fact, alpha has two A's in it. That's just my hidden helpful hint. I know beta has an A in it, but you kind of got to associate something to keep these two straight. So nonetheless, these two hormones are made by two different kinds of islet cells in your pancreas. So it says here that these hormones operate under humoral control. What does that mean, humoral control?
Blood,
good. So blood levels of glucose will encourage the pancreas to release either insulin or glucagon. Since the pancreas serves as the control center, it is the one that regulates blood glucose levels in the body. So a lot of times when we talk about negative feedback loops, we talk about your brain being the control center, but not the case here with blood glucose levels. Blood glucose levels are regulated by your pancreas. So in terms of normal blood glucose for a non-diabetic person who is fasting, what are the levels we should expect to see? What are some numbers that we should see?
Like
80 is a good number. Yep. Above 120 is kind of getting into a pre-diabetic or a diabetic range. Below 70 is getting you down into a hypoglycemic range. So, you know, most people are going to feel functional between 70 and 120 units per deciliter of blood. Diabetics may have blood sugar levels that are up like 800 or 1,000. And if you think about your normal range being 70 to 120, that's way out of range, right? Okay, so I'd like to talk to you about, you know, diabetes. This particular form of diabetes is called diabetes mellitus. And I want to make a point here. This is not the form of diabetes we discussed the other day when we talked about ADH. By the way, what was that form of diabetes called? Insipidus. Good. That was insipidus. All right. So the three classic symptoms or signs of diabetes, got you some lines there to fill in, include the three polys: polyuria, polyphagia, and polydipsia. Okay, so we've got polyuria, which is excess urination. What about polyphagia? It is hunger. Good. So why would a person with diabetes be hungry?
Need more sugar.
Need more sugar. Because what's happening to their sugar? And they pee it out. Okay, so anything above 180 units of blood sugar gets lost in your urine. So if your blood sugar is 300, if your blood sugar is 800, then you pee out everything above 180 units into your urine. So here's kind of an interesting tidbit. Back when you studied osmosis, what did we always say water followed?
Salt.
Yeah, and now it follows sugar. So if you happen to have 180 units of blood sugar or higher, you're going to urinate away those blood glucose molecules, and water follows. That explains polyphagia, and that explains polyuria. And of course, if you're urinating away all of these fluids, that explains polydipsia, because you're thirsty to replace the fluids that you lose. There is one symptom present in this form of diabetes that is not present for the ADH problem diabetes. What is that symptom? Yeah, glucose in the urine. We don't expect to see that with that diabetes insipidus, but we do expect to see polyuria and polydipsia with diabetes insipidus. So hungry and peeing out sugar is not an issue for that ADH insufficiency. Symptoms of diabetes mellitus range from nausea and vomiting to confusion, having headaches. There's a whole host of symptoms that someone may not connect back to having high blood sugar. Someone who is a type 1 diabetic may experience ketoacidosis. That particular disorder is related to breaking down fats and turning them into what?
Glucose.
Sugar. Yeah, glucose or sugar. Good. And so that particular issue is something that we tend to see. We produce ketone bodies in the urine. We're a type 1 diabetic. And then long-term issues with diabetes have to do with excess sugar in our cells and tissues and surrounding tissue spaces and excess fluids. So you can see everything from blindness to heart damage to kidney damage and even amputation of limbs that can come from a long-term issue with diabetes mellitus. We typically look at two forms of diabetes, a type 1 and type 2. Which one of these is insulin dependent? Type 1, good. What age group typically develops type 1?
Juveniles,
good. And of course, type 2 is more likely an adulthood issue. What are some things that can lead to type 2 diabetes?
Obesity,
good.
Or diet.
Diet issues, right? Lack of exercise. So they do say that type 2 diabetes can be managed. It may not become insulin dependent. And we can try to help contribute to managing it through diet and exercise. Okay. There's another type here I just wanted to mention called gestational diabetes. This may come for a woman who is pregnant, and we have to watch her blood sugar throughout that pregnancy. Gestational diabetes does not necessarily mean that that mother is going to have diabetes later in life. We look at it simply as a risk factor. It may increase her risk for type 2 diabetes later in life, but it's not a guarantee that she will form type 2 diabetes. So this is not our last talk about insulin, glucagon, or diabetes. We'll hit this again when we get further along into our digestive system. For now, of the two hormones, which one raises blood sugar? Glucagon and insulin will do what to blood sugar? It decreases it, right. So would you consider these hormones to be synergistic or antagonistic? They're antagonists, good.
I have hypoglycemia, so where does that lie?
They say that hypoglycemia sometimes falls with excess epinephrine and norepinephrine. So they say that it may not be these two that are causing the problem, but rather like the sympathetic nervous system that causes it.
Like burning sugar too fast?
Burning sugar too fast, yeah. If you're stressed or whatever, something like that, even if it's just studying for a test, that can burn up your sugar. Yeah. All right, how about questions so far? Anything on pancreas or adrenal gland disorders? I think I'm going to let you guys read pineal gland and melatonin and thymus gland and thymosin on the next page. That way we can move along into blood typing. So just make yourself a note to be sure and read that. It's just a very small portion at the top of the page. There's also a worksheet starting on page 17 if you'd like the answers to the worksheet. They're in the D-Tool announcements. I believe, if I remember correctly, pages 17 through 19 are in that announcement area. And I know your brain is full from endocrine system, so we'll switch gears and do something different. Any questions on endocrine? Anything I can help clear up for you? I'm actually going to do your next chapter a little bit out of order. I'm going to take you over to page 29, and we'll work this chapter backwards. We'll eventually get all of it done. We're just going to do it out of order.
With the essay questions, I haven't looked at the sample exam online, but is there samples or... Are there samples of the exam online for the essay online?
There are samples. And one, I have not made you guys test out yet, but once I do that, I can give you some helpful hints.
Okay,
cool. Just remind me, because it'll probably be next week when I start making that out. So page 29 is blood typing, and we're just going to do this first, and then we'll go back and cover the basic content first. So if you are needing some help getting blood typing straight, there's a bunch of resources out there, and I thought I'd show you a couple of them. These are linked in the D2L announcements. Just go to our course, look at the homepage, and in the news right there in the center, there should be some links to these great resources. The Nobel Prize website has a really fantastic set of games. They toss out patients for you that need blood, and they provide blood bags that you have to select the correct or a matching blood bag for that patient. So you can play this as many times as you like. They'll even award you different levels, so it kind of makes you feel good that you're getting it done right. So you can actually play this Nobel Prize game until you get this stuff mastered. If you want to try a different game, the Red Cross also has a blood typing game. So, you know, you can read this stuff until the cows come home, but I think until you actually have to work with it, then it really either makes sense or it doesn't make sense. There is a chart in your workbook that we're going to cover together, and I would not advocate memorizing that chart. I would work with it. You know, if you can look through these games and play these until you get the questions right, that's where your comfort level needs to be. All right, so at the very top of your page there, that's page 29, let's talk about blood typing for just a moment. I need to give you some background information first. Our red blood cells are the ones that carry your blood types, our red blood cells. Generally speaking, if a cell has a surface feature, and that surface feature is recognized by your body, we call that a self-antigen. My surface features look okay to my body. Your surface features look okay to your body. But if we were to mix those cells, then there may be things on my cells that look foreign to your body and vice versa. So if we don't recognize those surface features on cells, we consider those to be antigens. They're basically foreign antigens. We have white blood cells. White blood cells typically fight infection or foreign invaders. And they're the ones that are checking out those surface features to see if they are recognized as our own. If we recognize those surface features as our own, then we consider them to be self-antigens. If we don't recognize those surface features, we consider them to be foreign antigens. What should we do to foreign antigens?
Fight them.
Fight them. Yep. Get rid of them and fight them. Right. So what do we use to fight those foreign antigens? Antibodies, right. and they're made by a particular type of white blood cell. We'll learn about that one, in fact, in this chapter. So let me give you an example, kind of not thinking about blood typing at all. Every fall they advertise flu shots are available. And I saw a sign the other day that said flu shots are out. I'm thinking, gosh, it seems early, but I guess they're starting early this year with flu shots. But flu shots are advertised every single year because the antigens in the flu virus seem to change every single year. So let's say that you get the flu shot and you're good to go. And come, you know, 3 weeks, a month later, you have now built up antibodies against those foreign antigens. So what is building up the antibodies going to protect you from?
Getting the flu.
Getting the flu, right. The catch is they have to get the formula, right?
Last year they did not.
A lot of people got sick. So it's you're right, a guessing game, because they have to hope that they're giving you the antigen that's going to be the prevalent flu virus for that year. So let's take last year, for instance. Let's say that you got the flu shot and you got the flu anyway. So if you're introduced with a flu virus, let's say you caught it from touching some dirty doorknob somewhere, that flu virus gets into your body and your body does not recognize the surface feature of that virus. You know, these outside features here are what we're looking at on the outsides of foreign cells. Viruses have similar things on their outside structure. Your body looks at that and says, that does not belong to me. I'm going to get rid of it. So it manufactures antibodies to get rid of those surface features. By the way, those antibodies are Y-shaped structures, and they are built very specifically to those foreign invaders. Okay? So if you got the flu virus in January and you built antibodies against it, could you possibly get the very same flu virus a month later?
No.
It'd be highly unlikely. Why not?
You have the antibodies to fight it off.
You got the antibodies to fight it off, right. Low levels of antibodies circulate throughout your lifetime. That's quite a thought, isn't it? So if you've had one virus at age 5 and it comes back to visit you at age 10, if it's the exact same virus, then your antibodies say, you've been here before. We didn't like you then, and we still don't like you now, so we're going to get rid of you. So those same antibodies are still present 5 years later. And once you encounter that same virus 5 years later, or 10 years later, or 25 years later, you build even more antibodies even more quickly to launch an attack. So that's the cool thing about antibodies and the cells that make them. We have memory. It's called immunological memory. And we can fight off those foreign invaders if we see them, those exact same ones, at some point again. Okay, so do I need to make antibodies if I don't have the antigen to trigger them?
No.
In fact, it'd be impossible to make antibodies if there wasn't something to trigger making them, right? Okay, so antibodies are only made, and they're made to match a specific foreign invader. And some of these surface features out here are foreign to us. Some of them look like us. So if they're ours, they call them self. If they're foreign, of course, they're foreign antigens. So I'd like to talk for a moment about the ABO blood group and its antigens and antibodies for just a moment. The ABO blood group is one of many blood groups. It just happens to be the one we most commonly use to do blood typing. Okay? So the ABO blood group is based on two antigens, an A antigen and a B antigen. All right, and there's some information about halfway down your page. That's where I'm going to take you now. Those are the two antigens ABO is based upon. No antigens, we consider you to be type O. If you have both antigens, A and B, we consider you to be AB blood type. And if your antigen is A, your blood type is A. If your antigen is B, your blood type is, guess what?
B.
Yep. Thank you. and hit the light for a few minutes. Okay, so you are either type A, you're type B, you're type AB, or you're type O. So for your ABO blood group, you are one of those four blood types. By the time you're age 5, you may have built antibodies against an antigen that you consider to be foreign. We're exposed to foods and bacteria, and those things trigger our bodies to make antibodies against the foreign antigens by around age 5. So if you've never had a transfusion before, you still carry antibodies against foreign blood types in that ABO blood group. So, of course, it depends on what your blood type is, whether or not you carry those antibodies. Let me start you off with blood type A. Okay, and we're just going to work with something real simple today. I've got paper plates, and these paper plates are red blood cells, and they carry antigens on their surface. So these triangle shapes are my A antigens. This is an anti-A antibody. If I am blood type A, do I need anti-A antibodies in my bloodstream? Why is that a bad idea? It's going to fight it, right? And you'll notice that these have a pretty nice fit with the antigen. So if I'm type A, I don't want the fighter in my bloodstream fighting my own blood type. You know what that's called? Autoimmune disorder. Okay? So we don't want the antibody fighting our own antigen. That'll kill you. Okay, so not a good idea. Let's see. This is an anti-B antibody, and I want you to notice the shape here on the antibody is different. And in fact, it does not match up with my A antigen. It's a totally different shape. So it's okay for me to carry an anti-B antibody in my bloodstream because it's not going to bind my own antigens. Okay, so in fact, if your blood type is A, you have an A antigen, and you carry around in your bloodstream a small population of anti-B antibodies. There we go. Okay. So even if you've never had a blood transfusion, you're going to have these small groups of antibodies in circulation. Let's do another one. This is blood type B, okay? And you'll notice that I'm carrying an anti-B antibody, and it looks like that's a pretty good match with my B antigen. If I am blood type B, do I need an anti-B antibody in my body? No. So what I actually carry is an anti-A antibody. So you can see that the antigen right here, or rather the antibody, has a shape that only fits a different shape antigen. So it will not bind with this particular antigen. Okay? So let's do this. Let's say that my blood type is B, and I am toting around some anti-A antibodies. Okay? This person needs a blood transfusion. Can I give them B blood? If their blood type is B, I can give them B blood. Good. Can I give them blood that has A in it?
No.
Why not? Good, you got an anti-A antibody that you carry around. You're going to fight off anything with A on it. So if this is your blood and we want to donate to you type A blood, that's going to cause a problem. So when anti-A antibodies bind A antigen, boy, this is a mouthful, right? When anti-A antibodies bind A antigens, we have agglutination occur. Okay, and so what happens is that antibody, let's see, we can get it to like stick on there, and it clumps that blood cell. This one will attach to another blood cell, and you've got this big clumped up mess that's now flowing through your bloodstream. Your capillaries are only big enough for one of these to go through single file, and if you take a clump through, then you can cause ruptures in your blood vessels, especially those tiny capillaries. So that's why agglutination is seen as a bad thing for your body. By the way, the first transfusion reaction is not terribly severe because you've got a small group of antibodies in circulation. But the second time, your body says, you know, you messed with me, and I'm going to be ready for you next time, and I'm going to increase my populations of antibodies. So the next time you mess with me, I'm really going to fight back. So the second transfusion is much more severe because you've increased numbers of your antibodies against those foreign invaders. Okay, let's go back to our initial issue. Let's see. We had B blood. B blood carries anti-A antibodies. Now, I want to donate to this person some AB blood. You'll notice I've got two different antigens on the surface of the blood cell. Can I give this AB blood to the B person?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. AB blood? Okay for the B person?
Yes. No. If it was B going to A, it would be okay. But if it's AB going to B, it's fine.
That's all right. If it was just A, it'd be, yeah. If it was just A, it'd be a real problem, wouldn't it? So, what is the problem with giving AB blood? See those two different antigens on there? Why can't we give this blood to this person with B blood?
Because of the anti-A antibody.
Yeah, this person carries an anti-A antibody. That antibody is built to bind that A antigen, okay? So B antigen-wise, we're good to go. It's the A antigen on this foreign blood type that's going to be the issue, okay? And so when we get a hold of this blood, we're going to agglutinate or clump that foreign antigen. And so that makes this clumped-up mess travel through our bloodstream. This is O. O has no antigens on the surface. Can I give that one to my B person?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Any problems here? There's no antigens that are going to cause any problems. So antigen-wise, then we're good to go, mm-hmm. Okay? So that's why they consider O to be the what? Universal donor, yep. So there's a next set of blanks for you. Call it the universal donor anymore. O in some textbooks is put universal donor and they put a star beside it and they say,
negative.
What's the problem?
O negative.
Yeah, O negative, you're right, would be the quintessential universal donor. If you are O, you have no antigens on the red blood cell surface. Blood cell wise, you're good, right? I can give this blood cell to anybody and have no trouble, okay? So in that aspect, yeah, O negative is the best one because it's a universal donor.
Right.
But if you're giving whole blood, what are you getting in the blood plasma?
The antibodies.
Yeah, antibodies. I've got an anti-B antibody and I've got an anti-A antibody. These are floating around in your blood plasma. Mm-hmm. So if I say I need whole O blood, I not only get the blood cell, but I get these antibodies. All right, so let's think about that. This is your A person, right?
Mm-hmm.
Blood cell-wise, we're compatible, okay? But if we're getting whole blood, what am I also getting?
Antibodies,
right. And there's an anti-A antibody that can bind my own antigens. The risk for agglutination is small. Your body will use this donor blood. It will discard it after a few weeks, and we recycle it out of our bodies. What's important is that we get these blood cells to keep us alive during the emergency, and we'll eventually handle these small amounts of antibodies. So first transfusion here is, you know, not a problem. Second transfusion is not a problem. Third transfusion, because you're not making these antibodies, they're coming with the donor blood. So it's coming in donor blood. You'll eventually get rid of it by degrading it through your liver and discarding it through your kidneys. Okay, but I did want to mention that O negative doesn't come without risk. It comes with a potential for small amounts of agglutination when you give the whole blood with antibodies to a person who has that particular antigen. Okay, so I just want to mention that as a disclaimer for this one. All right. Let's talk about Rh for just a moment, and then I'm going to cut you guys loose and work on a chart there. So there's a lot of different blood groups out there. ABO is a very common one. That's probably our most prevalent blood group that we use. And then we also talk about the Rh factor as an important blood typing mechanism. So if you'll flip over to page 30 with me. Okay, so with blood typing, in an emergency, when blood typing cannot be performed, any bag can do because the body needs the red blood cells to transport oxygen. There have been attempts at doing synthetic blood to get people's red blood cell population up for transport, and it doesn't seem to be as compatible as having the real thing. We can deal with agglutination issues after the fact, so in an emergency, even cold blood right out of the fridge is better than no blood at all. So in an ideal situation, these are the compatibility rules that we're looking at. In terms of Rh factor, this is a separate blood type. This factor is found on 85% of the population, so that means most of us are positive for the Rh factor. The very small group of people that don't carry the Rh factor are considered to be Rh what? They're negative, yeah. So if you've got the Rh factor, you're positive. If you don't have the Rh factor, we consider you to be negative. To avoid confusion, they also use an alternate letter of the alphabet. They use D. So if you are Rh positive, they say you have the D antigen. And if you're Rh negative, you don't have the D antigen. Okay, so there's kind of two ways that we can work with that. I did want to mention, unlike the ABO blood group, you do not automatically form antibodies in your bloodstream as a child against Rh positive if you are an Rh negative. It takes either exposure through a transfusion to form anti-Rh antibodies, or it takes a pregnancy for a female to form anti-Rh antibodies. So, kind of an interesting tidbit there. And this plays a role in transfusions for those who have never had a transfusion. You're not going to automatically be Rh, carrying an anti-Rh antibody. Just checking to see if you guys need this screen. Okay, so in terms of transfusions with the Rh factor, like I said, the first transfusion for a person who is Rh negative and receiving the Rh positive or the Rh antigen is typically a mild transfusion. If you start with an Rh negative person and you give them the Rh factor, it takes time to build anti-Rh antibodies. Okay. The second transfusion, however, the immune system is already primed. It knows exactly what to make. It knows how to make the antibody. So the second transfusion is actually a more severe more severe reaction, and we expect to see agglutination occur here. We expect to see capillaries damaged, and that's because the second go-around for an Rh-negative person, they're already waiting with those anti-Rh antibodies present. So I just want to emphasize here, the concern is for the Rh negative person. What does the negative person lack from their blood cells? Rh antigen, right. And upon exposure, they start making anti-Rh antibodies. All right, so let's kind of look at it another way. If you're Rh positive, can you get Rh negative blood?
Yes.
Yeah, no problem. If you're positive, you can get Rh negative blood. The other way around, though, is a little more tricky. If you're negative, though, you should only be given negative blood, not Rh positive blood, unless it's an absolute emergency. Pregnancy works the very same way. If you are an Rh negative mom, they blood type you early on in pregnancy, around week 28, and again at birth, they should give you some shot called the Rogam shot. And this shot is to help prevent you from making anti-Rh antibodies that are possibly carried by your fetus. If you're an Rh negative mom, they assume that you're carrying an Rh positive baby, and they treat the pregnancy as such. So they don't worry about blood typing the baby. That's not really the concern there. The concern is what you as mom are, and the potential that you as mom will make anti-Rh antibodies against your baby. The first pregnancy, it takes time for these antibodies to be built. So babies are born with mild issues, maybe some hypoxia or anemia. These antibodies can cross the placenta and attack the baby's bloodstream. So first pregnancy, baby's usually born with some minor issues, but you know, we're not looking at major problems. Along comes the second pregnancy. Let's say this was 200 years ago. There was no such thing as a Rogam shot then. So mom had one baby born okay, and every baby after that, if it was positive, mom is building these antibodies and fighting the baby's blood cells. So the second reaction is more severe. What kinds of problems might we see?
Miscarriage.
Serious issues like brain damage. You know, we're looking at not being able to transport oxygen. And so this particular disorder is called hemolytic disease of the newborn. And there's another really fancy name for it called erythroblastosis fetalis. But no matter what you call it, it is mom's anti-Rh antibodies that are attacking the baby's Rh antigens. Sure. The name of the disease or the whole issue?
The whole issue.
The whole issue, sure. The second time a mom is pregnant with an Rh-positive baby, she has populations of anti-Rh antibodies already present in her bloodstream. Because she is primed and ready to go and fight against that Rh antigen, then the second baby, the second, you know, exposure, so to speak, is more severe. So her antibody population is bigger this time. It attacks the baby's antigens, and of course that causes more severe problems in the infant. So stillbirth, miscarriage, brain damage, much more severe reactions can occur the second time for a second pregnancy. I think, you know, for families that, you know, before this was ever discovered and before we knew about this, imagine a family that had one baby that was more or less healthy. That was the first Rh positive baby born to an Rh negative mother. And then imagine, you know, no Rogam shot, so second baby born dead, third baby miscarriage, fourth baby stillborn, fifth baby. Imagine a family that had these pregnancies and the mother could never have a baby that was actually alive after that first one. So that would be the case if you continue to have Rh positive babies to an Rh negative mom. Okay.
How about if the mother is Rh positive and the baby's Rh negative, and does that automatically expose the girl, that baby, to the possibility of, like you say, that the first one could be born okay, but is it also the possibility the person might not be because of the mother having had positive blood and the baby having had negative?
They say not so much, because if mom is positive, she doesn't carry the antibodies. And if you think about the size of an infant, that infant may be slightly sensitized against mom's antigens, but the next infant is not going to be, every pregnancy is a separate incident, so to speak. So because of the size of the baby being so tiny compared to mom's body size, it's unlikely that the baby's going to form very many of these anti-mom Rh antibodies in the first place. I know that's tricky. And there's There's small issues with ADO2. So there's small issues like if baby is B and mom is A, there's small issues with being sensitized against each other that way too. But it seems to me that this is the big one. Yeah. So I found it in covering this content that the Rh factor is the biggest issue. So let's just take our A blood type one more time, and I'm going to put some Rh antigens on there. Okay, so this is going to be our Rh positive blood type. So in fact, if you carry both A and Rh, what do we call you?
A positive,
right. So if you're A positive, then the only antibody you're probably carrying is what?
B.
Yeah, you're probably carrying a B antibody. So if you come along and say, I want to give you some blood during the transfusion, the catch is I can get A, I can get Rh, I just can't get anything with
B.
Yeah. So that's the concern, because I may cause agglutination from being given that that foreign antigen. Let's do one more. Let's say that we have type O that I want to give to my A positive blood. Antigen wise, are we compatible? Antigen wise, we're compatible. Good. Let's say that we want to give a B blood to my A positive blood. This one's AB negative, by the way.
No.
What's the problem?
B antigen,
right? Okay, so that's an incompatibility. I am A positive, this one is B negative. Are these compatible? These aren't compatible. So, you know, that's the catch, is that positive can get negative as long as the other antigens are compatible with that blood type. Let me take you to the chart on page 31. Before we head there, y'all got any questions so far?
How would you treat a bleeding nation?
What's that? That could be one thing. They also give an immunosuppressant drug, because if you're agglutinating a foreign blood type, like through a transfusion, they want to make sure that you don't further agglutinate, so they'll immunosuppress to stop that. Rogam is not an immunosuppressant drug like cortisone or cortisol, but it basically stops antibody production by lymphocytes.
So if you were O negative and you had an emergency, you needed blood like right then, and there was no O negative available to give you, you could take O positive first?
They'll give you whatever they've got. Yeah. Cold, right out of the fridge. If they don't have time to type, they just preferably O negative first, but they'll grab whatever they can, and then they'll deal with compatibility issues after the fact. Yeah. So you're almost as ideal. Well, then you are the ideal for antigen compatibility. Yeah. Okay, let me take you through part of that chart, and we'll get you started with it, and I'll let you work on it and finish it. We're going to take blood type A positive to start with. I'm just going to draw one there so we have something visual to look at. An A positive blood cell has both A antigens and the Rh factor. But I think it will keep you straight if you say anti-B antibody instead of saying I've got a B antibody, because I think your brain somehow switches it around. So being very clear forces you to think about what you're saying. An anti-B antibody is the correct way to work with it. Before we keep on the chart here, can I have an anti-O antibody?
Doesn't have any antigens,
right? That's so. There's no antigens, so I can't really fight what's not there. So I can't have an anti-O antibody. How about an anti-Rh negative antibody? No such thing, right? It too is not there. So either you have the Rh or you don't, and so there is no such thing as an anti-Rh negative antibody. You can only fight antigens that are present on the surface. So when you're thinking about what blood types you can receive from, we have to be cautious about not violating our antibody list. That means we can receive from our own blood type, which is A positive,
and
negative. Good. Why is it okay to get A negative?
Because
the antigen is not there. Right? There is no Rh factor on an A negative blood type. We can get O positive. Antigen-wise, why is this compatible?
Because that doesn't have Rh.
So what they've got, which is an Rh antigen, is what we've got. And in terms of compatibility, antigen-wise, we match up. And is it okay to give O negative to the A positive person?
Yes.
Yeah. Because it carries no what?
Antigens.
No antigens. So you're not introducing something foreign to this A-positive person's blood. Notice when we talked about what we can transfuse, we did not include anything that carried B. So we didn't include B-positive, B-negative, anything with AB. We can't get the B antigen. Why is that? You carry an anti-B antibody, that's exactly right. This is just a way to think of it in a kind of a backwards aspect. Let's say that you walk into the Red Cross and you say, I'm here to donate blood. And you know, if you're like Stephen, you're O negative, they're just going to like drool all over you and put you in a chair as fast as they can, because we want to know who you can give that blood away to. Who can O negative give blood to?
Everybody.
He can give it to everybody, right? Who can A positive give blood to?
A negative.
Can we give it to anybody who is AB negative or A negative?
No.
No, because we are giving them
Rh.
Yeah, so we don't want to introduce to them an Rh factor. So why is it okay for us who are A positive to give blood to an AB positive person?
Because you share the same
antigens, right? I am not giving them something foreign, I am giving them exactly what they've got. Okay. Let's do A negative, and then I'm gonna leave the chart for you guys to work on as a practice mechanism. The only antigen an A negative person carries is, of course, the A antigen, so that's it. No Rh factor this time. Potentially, you could carry what antibodies?
Anti-B.
You got it. If you are in need of transfusion, A negative has limited options, only two types. What are they?
A negative.
Yeah, A negative and O negative. Why can't we give A positive to the A negative person? Yeah, we carry an Rh, anti-Rh antibody. We don't want to receive that Rh antigen. A negative goes to the blood bank and wants to donate. This person can give their blood away to four blood types. What are they?
A
negative.
A positive.
Good.
A negative.
So if you're wondering how we figure this out, we think about those blood types who can receive the antigens that we carry. We only carry an A antigen, and all four of these that we're donating to carry an A antigen. So antigen-wise, we're compatible. Have I given you enough to get started on this chart?
Yes.
Okay. See what you can do, and I'll be happy to help you with it in class on Tuesday.